I'm an appellate attorney by trade. Appellate comes from appeal, meaning calling, a word of early 14th century origin from the French appeler, to call upon, accuse, and the Latin appellare, to accost, address, summon, name. To appeal to someone is to solicit a response. To solicit a response from someone is to invite speech. More accurately, it is speech calling for more speech. An appeal thus presupposes an originary voice like etymology itself, and a respondent voice like the call of the law itself. For the law is not a point of origin, but a point of counterpoint, just as words mean an opposition, though they start in consensus. I am a conceptual poet by avocation. Poetry to me means that which exists as poetry within the institution of poetry. This is also a simple matter of call and response, for I could argue that even those attempts to exclude me from the institution of poetry are institutional attempts, and, as you know, once something is institutionally engaged, there you go. Or rather, here we are, listening to my voice within this, a certain poetic context. All of my callings are about mimesis, radical mimesis, the very real representation of the real. Perhaps by virtue of her more formalized engagement with reproduction, women have been the containers of the real, and men have fashioned their reproductions around this representation, and vice versa. We don't need to dive into the pools of prose on this somewhat banal thesis, for this is not my purpose or my point. My question is about conceptualism as mimesis, about reproduction as representation. For conceptualism is often reproduced text, most commonly via appropriation or erasure, the mashup, reiteration and regurgitation, though sometimes we swallow. In each of these techniques, there is an allegorical representation of what's been or being said somewhere else to some other effect and end, an echoing. Echo comes from echo, the Greek meaning sound, now meaning consensually, one, a repetition of sound produced by the reflection of sound waves from an obstructing surface, two, any repetition or close imitation as of the ideas or opinions of another, three, a sympathetic or identical response as to sentiments expressed, four, a lingering trace or effect. Echo from the myth of Echo, heretofore primarily significant in terms of her failed call and response with Narcissus, undisputed hero of psychoanalysis and pop psychosis, emblem of our emblematic age. Echo, to recap, was a nymph punished by Juno for her gift of gab, for Echo would distract Juno with discursive narratives of great interest, while Jove consorted with an assortment of other nymphs. Detecting this, Juno cursed Echo to mere reiteration. Wandering one day through the wood, Echo surprised Narcissus on a hunt. Being no more or less immune to visual allure than the next fellow, Echo happily repeated Narcissus's calls to come and let us join. As she reached for the boy, he fled, saying, according to Golding, I first will die ere thou shalt take of me thy pleasure, to which she could only respond, take of me thy pleasure. Now, while much attention has focused on Narcissus, the cute one, very little seems to have fallen upon Echo. In her essay, Echo, Spivak rightly points out that the myth of Narcissus is a tale of the construction of the self as object of knowledge. Spivak sees the story of Echo in this tale as the story of punishment, in which the punished ethically asserts her colonized subjectivity, as the Latin cannot literally reiterate Narcissus's use of the second person interrogative, which repeats in English as the imperative, when Narcissus asks, why do you fly from me? Via this grammatical, or more precisely conjugational, gap, Echo becomes the unintending refusal of the trap of the sovereign subject. For her part, Irigaray argued that Echo's fractured reiterations were a perfect example of imperfect mimesis, a subjective subversion of the mirror that women are supposed to be for men, an exercise Spivak dilated and described as strategic essentialism. In this sense, Echo herself becomes the obstructing surface that resounds. But I am interested in Echo's pure malevolence, as an instantiation of a kind of radical evil that I advocate as the fate of poetry. Poetry is pure materiality, as pure presence, as the copious fact that propels one into the kind of Dionysian fatalism that causes hearts, minds, and corks to pop, that is to say, to unstop. And by fate, of course, I mean state. For as with myth and poetry, what will be already is. There are two motifs to consider relative to echo, rape and connaissance. Connaissance most familiarly as familiarity, and connaissance also as reconnaissance, as what my army daddy and granddaddy would recognize as an information-gathering adventure, and what we here might profitably consider as a rethinking or thinking come again. The difference that lies in repetition, the difference that makes all the difference. For those who have not studied their Ovid, all gods rape, sometimes forcibly, sometimes fraudulently, sometimes consensually. For just as children cannot legally consent to sex with an adult, given power imbalances between parties and inequity in comprehension of what the act entails, so too the consent of any mortal to sex with a divinity is mooted as beyond comprehension, beyond connaissance. There is an interesting aside here about the rape of a virgin, a rape we rather callously celebrate. However, more to my point, Narcissus is the direct product of a rape, his mother ravished by a river god. Echo's fate of representation is the result of her collusion in Jove's dalliances with mountain nymphs, which human resources would consider sexual harassment, given, at minimum, the institutional power imbalance between parties. Thus, in a prime example of contrapasso, Echo is not only deprived of agency, internally defined as original narrativity, but becomes the agent of a subjectivity, the use of a subject as object of forcible oral copulation, given, as Lacan said in other words, that the ear is the orifice we cannot close. For his part, Lacan added the voice along with the gaze, the phoneme, and the nothing to the list of Freudian partial objects, breast, feces, and phallus, objects of desire, cause of partial drives. He later reconceived the voice as the object of the desire of desire, the objet petit a. Speechless in this sense, soundless in the sense of the said as the unsaid, and vice versa. And of course, the voice in psychoanalysis is in both senses the very fact of analysis. Put another way, the nothing that cannot be said that must be endlessly reiterated. The discourse of the hysteric, constantly asking what she wants. The discourse of the master who stupidly tells her. In another context, I have posited a discourse of the slave as the discourse of conceptualism. The slave repeats, but to no other and to no end. The slave repeats. This is repetition, is mere mirroring. And for those of you who care, the discourse of the slave is rendered schematically as the mirror image of the Lacanian master's discourse. The upshot of the discourse of the slave is that it produces nothing. It is the point at which call does not effectuate response. For there is no original, and the normal discursive apparatus fails. It is the engagement of non-engagement, best exemplified by the childhood pastime of simply repeating what your sibling was saying until he or she became suitably enraged. Because what he or she knew was that you were instantiating the conditions under which they absolutely failed as a cognizable subject. Put another way, the discourse of the slave produces in the master the divided subject, that which the master must repress in order to retain his mastery. Conceptualism does this as Echo does this, for the fact is that Echo presents Narcissus with a false and foolish choice, one that exposes him to nothing but the horror of himself. Put another way, call all you want, but there's no one home. When Narcissus was an infant, his mother asked Tiresias, the transsex seer, whether he will live to a well-ripened age. Tiresias says he will, as long as he does not know himself. Lacan says the function of language is not to inform, but to evoke. Celan says, la poésie ne s'impose plus, elle s'expose. Lacan says, what I seek in speech is the response of the other. What constitutes me as a subject is my question. Kafka says, guilt is never to be doubted. Put another way, to know oneself is to know the guilt of having a self. For his part, Barth believed that listening creates an intersubjective space where I am listening also means listen to me. At first glance, so to speak, Echo is one such space, but she is one, so to speak, who is not one. She listens but does not speak. She repeats. She is the voice inside your head, outside your head, the voice that is yours and not yours, you and not you. The voice is matter of fact. The voice is the fact of death, of your death, the recorded voice. Echo is malevolent because she bears witness to the false hope of intrasubjectivity. More, she lays bare the hypocrisy of this hope, this desire that is not a desire for anything but desire. For the only thing worse than meeting one's soulmate would be to meet one's soulmate. Echo is radically evil because she exposes the fact of the unspared self. What Echo gives Narcissus is Narcissus himself. He cannot but know himself as she regurgitates the sound from his mouth, pouring them into his ears. Tier 1's voice is to declare, I don't sound like that. Tier 1's voice is like Kastrop spotting his hand beneath the x-ray to see what one should expect to see but what does not intend to see, one's own grave, one undone, dissolved into airy nothingness. But this is tiresome, me telling you what to think. It's the hackneyed use of the voice's voiceover, authorial and authoritative, voix noir, let us join. In her admirable book, Kaja Silverman said that the voice is the site of perhaps the most radical of all subject divisions, the division between meaning and materiality. Consider Benjamin's considered opinion that the essential quality of literature is not statement or the imparting of information, hence something inessential. A bad translation, said Benjamin, was the inaccurate transmission of inessential content. The true task of the translator was to break through literality to produce the echo of the original. Put another way, there is no need to translate experience, meaning for meaning, signifier for signified, but there is a mandate to transcribe. For in this sense, Derrida was wrong. It is not the letter that will always reach its destination, but its sound. The essence of presence is the voice. I don't need to tell you what to think if I can tell you what you are thinking. Conceptualism is a radical mimesis conjoined to radical alterity. The reiteration defeats the originary intent, the originary articulation, by demonstrating that there is no real point of real origin. There is no correspondence of communication, no relation from one to one, no listen to me in the I am listening. There is a textual place, and in this place there is the receipt of the place, the given possibility of meaning without meaning. My Statement of Facts project is the first volume of a trilogy of self-appropriation taken from my appellate briefs and represented as poetry. I represent indigent sex offenders and sexually violent predators. All my clients are guilty because they are said to be so. Guilt, like poetry, is an act of rhetoric, a speech act, an act often of some witnessing. Statement of Facts reiterates the reiterated narratives provided by witnesses. The crimes stay mostly the same, though the voices and ancillary details change. If the phoneme is the infra-thin distinction between statements, the infra-thin of violence, it's its meaningless facticity, the random individuality of its random victims. Put another way, for the first time in poetry, a rape is a rape is a rape. Conceptualism in this sense is a context, and I will be cuntish here, for if the ear is the orifice we cannot close, the mouth is the trap we cannot keep shut. So that citation is revealed as castration. It mocks authority by showing the lack of authority from the non-source of authority. To rephrase Brecht, what is the crime of being Derrida compared to the crime of citing Derrida? Perfect mimesis is radical as it takes the essence of the thing without the thing's permission and puts it to no end. The annihilation of the function of the text reveals the textual abyss, which is, as I have stated elsewhere, a mountain guised as a void. There is no reading but thinking, no material but materiality, no information but information processing. The question is not about the translation of experience, but the need to transmit experience revealed in its transcription, leaving the trace of poetry. What is poetry? Simply put, poetry is not not poetry. Last March, I was asked to lecture at an undergraduate poetry class outside Chicago. I gave them a poem by Wordsworth and told them to make it into a poem. They could do anything to Wordsworth they liked except add words. They then read their constructions, their cuttings and pastings, their deconstructions, the poem they found when they erased. For my contribution, I read the Wordsworth poem unchanged by me, some stupid poem about a tree. Mutatis mutandis, the ensuing conversation had nothing to do with either the stupid poem or the stupid tree, but everything to do with poetry. Gender is, at least partially, performance, says the lady. So is poetry. Conceptualism fuses performance and performativity, subject and object, like the reflected of a woman, not as two great things that go great together, but as a common occupation. Conceptualism creates a place for latency in the subject that encounters the object. Reading statement of facts, one reacts, but it is your reaction. You cannot help but know yourself. Similarly, or contrarily, there is my boycott project in which I take iconic feminist texts and perform an intervention modeled on a combination of Lacan's maxim, La femme n'existe pas, and artist Lee Lozano's untitled 1970s boycott project, substituting all references to women with their male counterparts so that the world is made entirely of the sex that is one. And how does one encounter such a world? How does one read lines such as, one is not born, but rather becomes a man? And men don't have penis envy, men have dick envy. This too is a statement of facts. In his admirable book, A Voice and Nothing More, Mladen and Dallaire says, ethics requires a voice, but a voice which ultimately does not say anything. The reason for this content silence is that the voice may act as pure call, which commands nothing specific and offers no guarantee. In one and the same gesture, it delivers us to the other and to our own responsibility. Our own responsibility, not, it should be noted, our own responsibility for. The ethical voice is enunciation without statement. This is the crucial point, the touchstone of morality. The voice is an enunciation, and we have to supply the statement ourselves. The enunciation is there, but the subject has to deliver the statement and thus assume the enunciation, respond to it, and take it on his or her shoulders. My statement of facts is published as print on demand. When several publishers refuse to drop the project as unethical, that is to say, as too unethical, the availability of print on demand not only permitted a brave and fundless publisher to host the project, but also shifted the site of enunciation. The responsibility of the iteration now falls directly onto each reader, shifts literally to the mode of production, echoing the content itself, or vice versa. For connaissance is context, con as in criminal, involving an abuse of confidence, a persuasive lie, and I will be convincing here, for the fact is there is no totalizing reading of the work, no reading at all, no author to gloss over with whom to contend, no point of disputation or illumination, just sheer materiality, just the statement of fact, just the shit in your head. Put another way, the voice means. Put another way, this is pure excrescence, or the excrescence of excrescence, the shit shits, and what to make of it. Within conceptualism, the statement is revealed not as a speech act, but as an act act. I have said elsewhere that all conceptual work is allegorical. I'm interested in allegory because allegory is the scratch to the itch of transmission. Allegory is excess meaning, meaning that cannot be contained or circumscribed by the object that triggers it. In the world post-Benjamin, post-1980s appropriation art, post-abject but not post-objection, where the emergent field is as level as the noggins it swims in, allegory is nothing more and sometimes much less than part of the materiality of a work. It means nothing but that it means. This is its pathos and promise. Put another way, I'm a mouthpiece. I reiterate and refract the words of others and of myself indiscriminately in order to make them mean, not something else, just mean. Those who would call upon me to respond to their reading with my own are looking to me for mastery, or at least subjectivity. But as Robert Fiderman has said, I am interested in subjectivity, just not my own. What I mean or what I mean by is irrelevant to the act of the text. What I mean is meaningless to you, the ear, that is to say, the context of the constituent subject, or should be. Con as in Kant, for the Kantish truth is that what cannot be repeated is the context, and that is the only remaining place of poetry. Authorship doesn't matter. Content doesn't matter. Form doesn't matter. Meter doesn't matter. All that matters is the trace of poetry. The echo effect. Heidegger said the echo is the human response to the word of the mute voice of being. Law itself is the echo of a desire that cannot and must not be fulfilled. Thou shalt not kill, but manifestly thou shalt kill, and often. Thou shalt not have any other gods before me confirms the existence of multiple omnipotence. Narcissus is ethical because he does not, in Lacanian terms, cede his desire. Echo is ethical in Kantian terms because she does her duty. The truth is that truth is nothing but an effect of language, a rhetorical effect, like guilt, like poetry, an echo effect, a testimonial to the silence that is not silence, where there is no gap permitting self-awareness beyond the sheer and terrifying awareness of self, unmitigated self, self as raw object of raw self, as the other opens the mouth and has one's own vomit out. Put another way, stop calling, I don't want to think anymore. Which may finally put one in the way of Antigone, who said most unethically, I speak for me.
Introducing some kind of concept of complicity into this situation. Mark's going to give a talk about his the structure of complicity between intellectuals and things they oppose, as amongst other things. Mark.
Hearing my echo of myself now, but perhaps it will always have been an echo. When I began writing about it, to write about complicity was to provoke dismissal, disavowal, even a disowning. It was the mid-1990s, and I was in America writing about South African intellectuals and apartheid. Popular resistance had brought white minority rule to its knees, and to talk about complicity was to spoil the party, to rain on the parade. Unless, of course, it was one's enemy's complicity in the system. Heidegger's enthusiastic affiliation to the Nazi Party was the bad example for the 1990s. And if one could get approving nods in New York by comparing Afrikaner nationalist ideologues to the master of Freiburg, how could one possibly use the word complicity in relation to black consciousness intellectual Steve Biko, even unless, of course, it was one's enemy's complicity in the system. Heidegger's enthusiastic affiliation to the Nazi Party was the bad example for the 1990s. And if one could get approving nods in New York by comparing Afrikaner nationalist ideologues to the master of Freiburg, how could one possibly use the word complicity in relation to black consciousness intellectual Steve Biko, even if his use of the concept was pivotal to his vision of mental liberation for black South Africans? Academic and journalistic opinion had not yet caught up with the sea change wrought by South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which placed complicity at the forefront of the public investigation that began in 1996 of political crimes of the apartheid era. Although more people have begun to theorize about it since then, I don't want to say that common opinion fully assimilated the Commission's call for general acknowledgement of complicity, and not just of the complicity of one's enemy, and that attitudes to complicity have therefore changed. Perhaps, though, I now have greater insight into why reactions to a bona fide, non-polemical exploration of the subject were and tenaciously remain so negative. Before I delve into those reasons, let me begin by outlining some of the ideas about complicity and responsibility that I put forward in my book, complicities, the intellectual, and apartheid. There I distinguish between complicity in the general sense and complicities in the narrow sense. Drawing on and literalizing the word's Latin roots, I characterize complicity in the general sense as a folded togetherness, complicity, in a human being. It is over against this folded togetherness with the other that any instance of complicity in the narrow sense is to be judged. Examples of complicity in the narrow sense would include support for specific acts and policies that contradicted the idea of complicity with the other, which implied ethical responsibility toward the other. Because it was separation in theory and practice, apartheid was the prime example of its contradiction, and for that reason, the exemplary case confronting the intellectual as a figure of responsibility. Responsibility and complicity was the telegraphic concept I formulated in order to capture the situation of the intellectual in relation to the two senses of complicity in their contradiction. Answerable for acts and omissions, responsible for them before others. Mine was an attempt to formalize a European line of thought going back at least as far as Émile Zola, who in 1898 famously declared in J'accuse, his plea for the falsely accused Alfred Dreyfus, "Je ne veux pas être complice," I will not be an accomplice, or I will not be complicit. Zola's cry was taken up about a decade later in South Africa by writer and political leader Sol Plaatje, who embraced the cause of an imprisoned chief whom he styled the Black Dreyfus. Since then, there have been countless reverberations across the world along similar lines. When I began writing about complicity, Jacques Derrida's Of Spirit, Heidegger and the Question, his book on Heidegger's Nazism, was the most searching interrogation of the European tradition. Derrida's conclusion as a philosopher was that although not all complicities are equivalent, complicity in what it opposes arises from any unilateral stance of opposition. I think that a subscription to a humanism of some kind is inherent to the tradition, at least as it has been set to work in South Africa. Asserting a foldedness in common humanity when the other is dehumanized gives the stand taken by the intellectual a powerful rhetorical edge, even a raison d'être. This is clear in Archbishop Desmond Tutu's appeal to Ubuntu, the African ethic of reciprocity that teaches that a person is a person through other people, when it came to defining the larger purpose of the Truth Commission that he chaired. But if an appeal to the human sounds too general, too abstract, too wishy-washy, even too much like African kitsch, then the idea that I put forward can be phrased as follows. Any instance of complicity can be broken down conceptually into a horizon of action and a horizon of responsibility or answerability. Yeah, I'm helped tremendously by American philosopher Christopher Kutz's book on complicity. Complicity means being in on the act, either as a joint actor in a collective act or as a supporting player. The latter criterion gives us the word accomplice. When a judgment, condemnation, indictment, accusation of an act is made, in effect an attribution of guilt, a horizon of responsibility is invoked. In acting thus, whose rights, welfare, and so forth ought to have been taken into consideration but were or are not. In any charge of complicity, there would be the assumption that in the act there is or will have been a prima facie violation of somebody's rights, an injury to their welfare, and so forth. In short, a falling short of the horizon of responsibility or answerability. The judgment makes clear that the horizon of act and the horizon of responsibility do not coincide. Accepting that there may be never a perfect coincidence of horizons of act and responsibility, and there can always be debate, of course, about the relevant horizon of responsibility and about the material role of the accomplice, what a non-coincidence does is to prompt a decision, as Derrida puts it in Of Spirit, to avoid the worst. If this sounds like the law as it gropes blindly for justice, it is also the decision made by the intellectual. By my action or by my inaction, I participate in a crime. Hence, Emile Zola, I will not be an accomplice. This emphasis on avoiding the worst and one's personal complicity in the worst has, in my more recent work about South Africa's Truth Commission, led me to rethink or at least reframe the ideas I developed in complicities. Influenced by the psychoanalytic theories of Melanie Klein, I've been led to ask whether the entire schema of responsibility and complicity may not be rooted in fantasy, and to consider what the implications are, if it is. Klein is famous for revising Freud's account of the origins of the Oedipus complex and the development of the superego. According to Klein, our ethics, specifically what she calls reparation, stem from the dynamics of early life in which the infant, frustrated at the breast and its substitute objects, attacks and harms them in fantasy. Feeling very guilty, as Klein puts it, the infant then has fantasies that restore or repair the damage it has done. It makes good or it makes good again. In short, ethical action has taken place on the basis of a fantasy that harm has been done and that it can be undone. For better or for worse, to experience feelings of guilt is to us a sign that one must have done harm. As Marianne Faithfull once sang, and I'm not going to sing it, I feel guilt, though I know I've done no wrong. I feel guilt. I feel guilt. Klein's account of love, guilt, and reparation may be read as a redoing of Freud's Dostoevsky and Parricide, which analyzes how Dmitry Karamazov is found guilty of a murder that he did not commit because his accusers detect his guilt at the murderous feelings he had and sense his fear of punishment. To the extent that the complicity of a remote actor cannot easily be defined or delimited, the tendency of the intellectual to declare him or herself complicit can easily devolve into the idea that I was or will have been complicit in the worst, or in Dostoevsky, all the evil in the world. Freud often observed that it was the obsessional neurotic with his overwhelming burden of unconscious guilt who took up the cause of the other. When the Afrikaans poet Anki Kroch, reporting on the Truth Commission, weighed her complicity as an Afrikaner in apartheid in Country of My Skull, there came from the Afrikaner intellectual right the accusation of guilt psychosis. Whatever the motives of that accusation, the danger is real. In the South African case, the actual perpetrator, even if he is offered amnesty by the commission, will not come forward because he will, if the fantasy is spun out logically, always have been guilty of the worst, which means symbolically capital punishment. From a purely legal point of view, this makes a mockery of proportionality. What is to be done then if, just as it opens in us the ethical impulse, fantasy compromises a setting of ethics to work? This is where tough decisions have to be made, as Vanessa Place vividly perceives in her book, The Guilt Project, Rape, Morality, and the Law, published this year. Place protests a thirst for an ever-widening ambit of criminalization and draconian punishment of sex crimes in America. which he tracks down to a culture of guilt and an increasing saturation of the populace in the ever-proliferating guilty pleasures of internet sex and reality television. As she writes, observing how illegal narratives about rape typecast women as victims, this is a quick commodification of a pre-packaged morality, born of the need to keep intact our innocence despite our wet-thighed experiences to the contrary. Americans fancy that our moral precepts cannot be elided or cut to suit current trends. Like old family photographs, they are supposed to be preserved whole or not at all. But like the antique photo, our moral precepts are apt to hold an idealized black and white image of ourselves rather than the colorful truth. Our insistence on our own purity begins in the intimate and steamrolls out, becoming more common the further it goes from the private to the public sphere. And in our apple-cheeked desire to keep our precepts inviolate and ourselves guilt-free worms the deeper lie. We know what we are capable of, and this guilty knowledge lets us sell ourselves the need for constant surveillance of ourselves via the mall security camera or the roving wiretap and instantly redress others' transgressions via greater criminalization, harsher sentences, and the preemptive strike. If we were less guilt-ridden, perhaps we'd be more guilt-free. Place, in other words, is finely and critically attuned to how unacknowledged fantasy, including sexual fantasy, guides a vindictive American legal populism. But the most interesting part of her response as an appellate lawyer is to cross through the aporia of guilt by accepting the guilt of her client as having been established juridically, factually, and even in the eyes of the Almighty. Signaling a contrast to Zola, who stood by Captain Dreyfus when he was falsely accused, or the New York-based Innocence Project, which today employs DNA analysis to try to free the falsely convicted, Place writes, most of my clients are factually guilty by virtue of their acts. All are legally guilty by virtue of their convictions. My job is not predicated on innocence. The two consequences follow. First, as appellate counsel, Place will strive to have her client freed on appeal. Freedom of speech, she writes, is only relevant when the opinions are vile and due process meaningful only when applied to the daddy who rapes his son. Sex offenders are our most despised citizens. To defend them without reservation, I have absolutely to accept their guilt. Place's book thus details various arguments relating to DNA and to psychological classification, and a cultural argument about the prostitute-pimp relationship that, she writes, has constantly failed. The inspiration for this is a safeguarding of the constitutional rights of the defendant. In other words, it is a legal argument. The second consequence, even more profound and thought-provoking, involves an appeal for mercy. Mercy, like due process, being genuinely relevant only when guilt is not in doubt. The structure of Place's argument is close to that of Derrida, who wrote that, strictly speaking, one only forgives the unforgivable. It is easy enough to see that an appeal for mercy applies to someone appealing a prison sentence, but how might it apply to the advocate of stiffer sentencing? The answer, I would assume, that it is mercy instead of guilt that in Place's mind needs to be generalized. Her advocacy of mercy, which is moral rather than strictly legal in emphasis, is humanist in inspiration. Pretending that certain men are inhuman, she writes, or that evil lies outside logic, excuses us personally and politically from calculated mercy. At heart, mercy is simply the steady responsibility to safeguard the humanity of all, including those we hate. There is something refreshingly and uncompromisingly old-fashioned about Place's appeal to mercy. Its alternative is the sinful pride of putting sex offenders in a category of evil that allows us to define ourselves in opposition to them. And it is surely no accident that in her book, For a Friend Who is a Judge in California, she uses the name Portia. If the fantasy guilt we all feel is so powerful, so ineradicable, then mercy is what is in order rather than concealment and acting in bad faith on behalf of others by enacting sex offender laws. Megan's law, not mine, and 1,000-year sentences. In other words, Place's stance not only acknowledges complicity, but by acknowledging the fantasy that may be behind the acknowledgement and disavowal of complicity, it has the potential to go beyond the unanalyzed advocacy of, I will not be an accomplice. Place is emphatic. I am guilty. There might remain a possibility in this for infinite regress, or of a manic oscillation between guilt and unguilt. Another layer of reflexivity concerning one's complicity is nevertheless a salutary contribution to a system of moral and legal checks and balances, which, without that system, would simply be an unexamined field, a field for unexamined guilt run wild. After the break, Vanessa Place will be reading from a Statement of Facts. Statement of Facts is linked to the Guilt Project by an overlap of some of its case material. And one of the questions we'll be considering, I hope, later, is there any relation of this work of radical appropriation statement of facts to the ethical appeal made in the Guilt Project.